Okay, we call the case of Bailey versus Lincoln General Insurance Company. Counsel, your argument?
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Tom Overton on behalf of Julie Bailey. With me at counsel table is Rick Gleason, and also in the courtroom are co-counsel Paula Greisen, Laura Schwartz, and Ms. Bailey is here as well. May it please the court, we're here today for a de novo review, and we're asking the court to apply the factors in the Davis versus MLG case to the case that's before the court. These cases both involve almost identical facts, really. The Davis case involved optional coverage on a rental car. The Bailey case, our case, involves a different but optional coverage on a rental car. The underlying issue in both cases was the same, that is whether an exclusion from coverage was valid, and the behavior that caused the exclusion from coverage was the same, and that is we had an intoxicated driver. The only real difference is that in the Davis case it involved property damage to a car when it hit a pole, and in this case it involved Raymond Jewell, who was the insured driver, was involved in a traffic accident that resulted in the death of Julie Bailey's son and serious injuries to her. The facts are very important here because we're asking you to apply the reasonable expectation case that was set forth in Davis. And those facts, I'm not going to dwell on them because they're in the briefs, but we had an untrained rental agent at DIA with a transaction that took only 5 or 6 minutes. Mr. Jewell was not encouraged to read anything, even though there was a summary of insurance there. It wasn't provided to him, and in fact the entire policy was not provided to him. Instead, he was given a rental agreement that had both car rental language, you know, where you bring the car back, what does it cost per mile, that kind of thing, mixed in with insurance coverage. And it also involved a situation where you had to have knowledge, not more than a basic knowledge, a pretty sophisticated knowledge of Colorado insurance law combined with reading the policy to determine what was coverage was available.
What you're really talking about is the exceptions to the coverage, though, right?
Yes, what we're really talking about is the exceptions to the coverage. And what the nub of the argument is that Mr. Jewell was intoxicated. In this case, it was methamphetamines, we think. And he crashed the car. And they're saying, well, that's an exclusion under the crime exception, and we don't have to pay the insurance. But the reality is, from the standpoint of a reasonable expectation for Mr. Jewell, the insured, it was impossible for him to tell that. They could have done it right. They could have said, there are two policies. Under the Myers case, there's no exclusion for criminal acts or anything else up to the minimum coverage under the first policy. The second policy, if you act in this manner, then you avoid your coverage. But they didn't do that. They didn't say how their exclusions. What they did was they said, well, you have this coverage, and if you do something that violates the rental contract, then that may have an impact on the benefits under the coverage. And you had to go to a different point in the rental contract. In fact, we put it as Appendix 1 to the policy. There's a dispute as to whether it's clear, whether you have to move around. This is a de novo review, and I know that you will have looked at the policy and you will have made that determination for yourself. But it's important to remember, under long-established case law here in Colorado, that insurance contracts are not like other ordinary bilateral contracts. The court, and that's the Goodson versus American Standard case, and the court has, when interpreting insurance contracts, because they're not like ordinary contracts, they have a heightened responsibility. You have a heightened responsibility when reviewing these terms. That's the Wong case from 2007, H-O-A-N-G. And it's also clear that Colorado cases require specific notice rather than having for exclusions to be enforceable, rather than to have the insured parse through the terms of the contract. And that's true, even if a painstaking study of the policy would have indicated to the insured what those exceptions to coverage are. But that's not what we have here. We have reasonable expectations of the insured because he was told by the rental agent, you've got $1 million worth of coverage. You're covered bumper to bumper, that he had coverage. Now, the fact that a few weeks later, he became intoxicated and wrecked the car doesn't negate that coverage. And from the standpoint of the insured, there's only one policy here because they're given one document. They're not told their separate coverage. They're saying if you do these things, it may impact on the coverage. And there's no way that a reasonable insured could understand under these circumstances that they're even dealing with two different policies. Now, it's important because we're asking you to do this de novo review, and that when you're looking at the reasonable expectations, which is the test in Davis, it's important to keep in mind that there's just no way for the insured to tell.
I guess I'm getting confused here.
Okay,
he buys the extra coverage, right?
Yes.
He didn't have to take it.
Right.
The extra coverage had exceptions that seemed to kind of parallel the public policy against insuring criminal acts, right? We don't insure criminal acts. That's the law.
But that's not clear from the expectations of the insured at this point. Because the laws, we don't insure criminal acts except up to the statutory minimums. That's the Meyer case. And there was no indication that there was any separation of that.
I mean, you know, in the rental business here, I mean, you know, we're used to getting, you want to get up to the ski slope, right?
Right.
You buy the extra coverage, you get up to the ski slope. You're not asking to be read your rights, are you? I mean, we're going to do that? Is that required?
You should be given an opportunity to, and the question really is, what does the renter think there at the counter? What is the reasonable expectation of the renter in this commercial transaction? And when they're told you have $1 million worth of insurance, and they're not told if there's any exclusion, and there's no reasonable way for them to determine that there's any exclusion, unless they happen to know about the Meyer case, and when it looks to them like it says, well, this could void coverage, but it doesn't void all the coverage, you know, this could have been done right, Justice Hobbs, but it was not done right. And this court has said over and over that it's not the court's province to rewrite the policy to make it right. From the standpoint of the insured, it's one policy. The reason that's important is because it creates an ambiguity, which, and I don't want to get back to that in a second, but the ambiguity it creates is whether there might be insurance in this circumstance, there might be not be insurance in this circumstance. You might have benefits that are impacted if you do these things, but it doesn't tell you what those benefits are. Now, the ambiguity is important because clearly under the Davis case and other cases, if there's an ambiguity in the policy, then the court applies the factors in the Davis case and it's de novo review. But the Wong case, which came along almost 10 years later, says, I think, that the reasonable expectations test applies to all insurance policies, and it doesn't have to be ambiguous. The Wong case applied the reasonable expectations case to a policy that it said was unambiguous. And I may have created some confusion in the briefing because in our initial brief, looking at Davis, we said, yes, there has to be ambiguity, and we argued ambiguity, and we do still stand by the fact that there is ambiguity. But by the time we got the reply brief, we cited the Wong case, which says you don't even need ambiguity, at least the way we read it, to apply the reasonable expectations case test. So once you get to the point of reasonable expectations, you have to do the factual analysis. And what did this person reasonably expect the coverage to be? And the fact was, all he was told was, you're covered bumper to bumper. He was given this agreement that's indecipherable, and it's difficult to read even for somebody with law training who's familiar with the Myers case, because you have to think, okay, well, if you do this, and then you turn back to this other page, and it says, well, if you do any of these acts, then maybe your benefits are impacted, but what benefits are there? Because they don't set out that there's, well, the criminal acts exclusion doesn't apply to the first 25 per person, 50 per accident. And so it's not easy to tell or reasonable to expect that the person in that circumstance could even understand what coverage they were given. So what do? They rely on the fact that I paid this premium. I've got $1 million in coverage. I'm told I'm covered bumper to bumper, and therefore should be covered bumper to bumper. And this,
Mr. Overton, I'm a little trouble understanding sort of your sense of the broadness or the limitations on the reasonable expectations set test. I mean, even assuming it's unhinged from any ambiguity,
right?
Your argument tends to be almost towards a subjective thing that he didn't understand because he wasn't told. I think that you're implying maybe there's more to that, but I guess what I'd like you to talk to me about in sort of more general terms is, what are the reasonable expectations of someone renting a car and obtaining insurance when we all know, as Justice Hobbs has indicated, that people aren't reading these things, that policies probably aren't being provided, and details of coverage are probably not being given. I mean, what is reasonable to expect? Full coverage for everything?
I'd like to begin my answer to that question by saying it is an objective standard. It's not subjective. And why it's important here is because there was a summary of insurance that was available that wasn't given to him. The policy itself wasn't available. The insurance agreement is almost impossible to decipher given the size of the type, the way it's written, the fact that you have to flip back and forth. So under an objective test, you really can't tell. But to answer your question of the commercial realities of this transaction.
Well, finish with that one first. So okay. I understand all you really need to say is that the crime exclusion could not be reasonably anticipated. But your argument seems to go broader. It seems to be the reasonable expectations test in this particular case would cause a reasonable person to believe they were fully covered for anything.
Yes, it is. And the reason that's important is because we don't think you need to send this back for further determinations. Because if the reasonable expectations test are not met for the criminal exceptions, it's not going to be met for any other exception either under the way this
is. Just what I'm questioning you about and want you to see if you maybe can persuade me otherwise here is that the gist of that seems to be that a reasonable person buying insurance, you know, at a rental counter without really reading anything or being provided anything would expect probably better coverage than anybody in this room has coverage for everything.
I think that's right. That's exactly what he was told in this circumstance. You have bumper to bumper coverage. I mean, why would you buy $1 million worth of coverage, which is what he did here, and you had a $6,000 rental car? There's no other reason to buy coverage other than third-party liability coverage in that context.
Wait a minute. It's not just third-party coverage. It's thinking that it's going to cover you if you use the car to commit murder. So that's the problem.
But that's not what he did, and that's why this is like the Davis case. The guy got high and made some really bad choices, and he had disastrous results. But the conduct was basically the same as the conduct in the Davis case. He was intoxicated, and Davis, they hit a tree, and they were fighting over a $6,000 rental car. In this case, unfortunately and tragically, he killed a child and had grievous injuries to the mother. But the fact of the matter is, the guy went out several days after he rented the car, and he became intoxicated, and he drove intoxicated. He just had a different result.
Right answer to Justice Martinez's question. How is that objective? Just because of what the rental car lady said? You know, nobody reads those things, as you well know, and the Court of Appeals said. So what's the objective? Because she said bumper to bumper, right, that it would include...
reasonable because of the amount of insurance he purchased. There would be no other reason to purchase that amount of insurance. because he was told he was covered for everything bumper to bumper, and because there's no way for him to look at that agreement. Now, maybe he doesn't read it at the counter, but maybe he gets in the car and reads it before he takes off with it. We don't know, but there's just no way, based on what he was given, to determine that there was this type of exclusion. It just wasn't possible for him. And even if he could determine there was an exclusion there, he wouldn't know that it wasn't excluded up to the first 2550 of coverage. These are all jumbled in together. And as I said, it could have been written correctly, and maybe we wouldn't be here, but it wasn't written correctly, and the court shouldn't rewrite the policy. It said, basically, if you parse through it, which insurers are not required to do in these circumstances, but if you parse through it, it said, if you drive drunk, it's a violation of rental policy, and you lose your coverage. But you don't really lose your coverage. You lose part of your coverage, and that's why it's A, ambiguous, and B, violates the reasonable expectations test. I do want to comment on one thing, and I'm sorry if I haven't answered the question.
I think you're doing your best to answer the questions. It's just a very difficult area, and but I have one more approach at it, again, tangentially. It would never really be reasonable for someone to assume that they're going to be insured, against committing a felony. I mean, that just isn't, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and again, Mrs. Rice.
If I purchased a gun, I mean, I couldn't then buy insurance to say that I was going to be insured against any use, including murder, I might have with respect to that gun.
I'm
finished, thank you.
That's not what happened here. He didn't go out to say he committed a felony. He went out and got high. And whether he had this, then he got in a high-speed police chase that ended disastrously.
Right. But you're arguing this intervening cause, which is him getting high on meth, right, or whatever it was. And I understand that makes these facts more difficult. But isn't the bottom line still that you say that he reasonably felt that he was insuring himself against any criminal conduct for whatever reason, and irrespective of cause, that he might engage in with that car?
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
And I would respectfully disagree with you. I think it would be reasonable for me, because I'm familiar with the Myers case, and for anybody here that's familiar with the Myers case, to say if I rented a car at DIA, at least up to 2550, I've got coverage if I drive drunk. And in some circumstances, that can be a felony, and I think it is a felony almost in all circumstances. So it would be reasonable for him to assume that he could commit a felony and still have coverage. And there's no distinction here, again, from the standpoint of the person at the counter, it just looks like one policy. And when you read the thing, it just looks like one policy. So I guess I respectfully disagree.
I understand. That Davis case is odd in that sense, isn't it? I mean, that's a very hard standard for us to apply this whole reasonable expectation standard.
It's a de novo standard, and it's fact-specific. And it's hard in the sense that that I suppose there are competing public policies. And I would like to come back to that in a minute, but I want to finish my thought and answer to your question.
Sure.
And it does go to public policy. You know, we have a public policy in insurance to protect innocent victims when there's been purchase coverage. And any limitations on that should be viewed with disfavor. And that's the law that you have stated. But it's especially true here where the tortfeasor is not directly benefited. Person benefiting from the insurance would be the victim of the tort. And there's a case on that. It's the Ambassador insurance case. And I also want to make another point that really wasn't part of the briefs, but you all know that the Nunn case came out 8 days ago. It had to do with Basher agreements. And I think it's important for this court to realize the distinction between this case and that case factually. In this case, there was an assignment of the Mr. Jewell's rights to Ms. Bailey. And that happened prior to the trial. But unlike the Nunn case, there was an actual trial in front of Judge Popovich. There was insurance defense counsel. There was cross-examination and argument, and the judgment that was entered, done after notice to Lincoln General, was entered after a trial. The fact that Lincoln General chose not to attend that is really irrelevant at this point. But it is factually distinguishable in that sense, and I thought that was an important fact for the court. You know, I see I've got about 10 minutes left, and I would like to keep that for rebuttal. Thank you.
If it pleases the court, my name is Malcolm Mead. I represent the respondent, Lincoln General Insurance Company. The ultimate question presented by this case is whether a policy of supplemental liability insurance or insurance above and beyond anything required by statute, purchased during a rental car transaction, provides coverage when the rental agreement says that if you use the rental car to commit a felony, coverage is voided, and the customer in fact used the rental car to commit five felonies: second degree murder, vehicular homicide, first degree assault, and vehicular assault. Four judges have found that the plain language of the criminal act exclusion in the rental agreement bars coverage: Judge Hyatt of the Denver District Court and three judges at the Court of Appeals.
Well, shouldn't there at least be a summary that plainly discloses that in, exclusion? That wouldn't be very hard.
In fact, Your Honor, there was, in effect, a summary that discloses the exclusions. It's the first page, the front page of the rental agreement. They admit it's the first page, the front of the agreement, that lists the exclusions. Can't use the car to communicate.
And he received that?
Pardon me?
He received that? I mean, he had
Yes,
that.
That's the document he received, yes.
Okay.
It's the first page of the document he received. In the trial court, plaintiffs argued that the exclusions were ambiguous, contrary to reasonable expectations, against public policy, and unconscionable. Judge Hyatt of the Denver District Court rejected those arguments and found that the plain language of the criminal acts exclusion bars coverage. On appeal, plaintiffs abandoned their argument that the exclusions were ambiguous, but continued to press their arguments concerning unconscionability, public policy, and reasonable expectations. A unanimous panel of the Court of Appeals rejected each of those arguments, and again found that the plain language of the criminal acts exclusion in the rental agreement bars coverage, and that decision should be affirmed. When the rental agreement says that if you use the rental car to commit a felony, coverage is voided, and the customer goes ahead and uses the rental car to commit five felonies, including second degree murder, there should be no coverage under a policy of supplemental insurance. And this conclusion does not defeat reasonable expectations, is not contrary to public policy, and is not unconscionable.
Did he know that it was supplemental insurance, or did he just pay? Did the counterperson say, all right, here's some insurance, and here's some more supplemental to get it up to the $1 million?
She said you've got $1 million coverage. It's undisputed that he had excess insurance. There's never been a dispute in this case as to whether he had primary coverage. This argument that you don't know if you got primary or excess was not developed in the trial court. He always had primary coverage. Dollar provided the primary coverage. Dollar paid the primary limits. The question is, are the exclusions enforceable against the excess or supplemental insurance? That's the only issue that was debated in the trial court and the Court of Appeals. When approaching this case, it's important to remember what plaintiffs are not arguing. Plaintiffs do not argue that the criminal acts exclusion is ambiguous. In the trial court, plaintiffs argued vehemently that the exclusions were ambiguous, but they decided not to press that argument on appeal. Plaintiffs do not argue that the criminal acts exclusion somehow does not apply to the facts of this case. By not making these arguments, plaintiffs necessarily concede that the criminal acts exclusion is unambiguous and applies to this case. Although plaintiffs say a customer needs to read a lot of documents to fully understand the coverage and exclusions, they do not say a customer needs to read a lot of documents to understand the criminal acts exclusion. Although plaintiffs say the rental clerk incorrectly described coverage and I told them about no exclusions, They don't say her comments rendered the criminal acts exclusion ambiguous. It's useful to keep these points in mind when considering their arguments about reasonable expectations, public policy, and unconscionability.
Sorry, Mr. Mead, I didn't understand that last point about the statement made by the agent. That sounds not just ambiguous, but contrary to me, but maybe I misunderstood what you said.
See what I said. Plaintiffs do not argue that the comments by the rental clerk rendered the criminal acts exclusion ambiguous.
Didn't argue that in the trial court? Is that what you mean? Well, they have an argument now.
Well,
they've raised it in, I mean, we have a de novo review of the matter, so it seems to me that that's sort of a given, that that whatever the agent said wasn't too accurate.
Correct. What the agent said was not accurate. I didn't hear them say that her comments rendered the criminal acts exclusion ambiguous. I heard them say that based on her comments, you'd think you were covered for everything, and the questioning probed that. Well, does that mean you're covered for murder? I don't think you can construe her comments, you're covered bumper to bumper, to mean you're covered if you use the car to commit murder. I don't see how you get those two from, you get the point A from point B.
Mr. Mead, let me ask you, would this case be different if, you know, the methamphetamine was used and then we had a simple negligence action, accident?
The use of the methamphetamine would be a felony, and let's say the methamphetamine caused the accident, he's using the car under methamphetamine, it's a felony, there would be no coverage under the supplemental insurance. Of course, by law, he has the primary coverage, the coverage provided by Dollar, but there would be no coverage under the excess insurance.
All right. And
now, the accident itself would be negligence. I guess it's a line-drawing problem as to...
And would our considerations under reasonable expectations be different in any way?
I think it would be, it's as a matter of law, we cannot say that a customer has a reasonable expectation of coverage when using the rental car when you're high on methamphetamines. We have strong laws against the use of drugs like methamphetamines. That is a felony. Very few people do that, hopefully. Very few people use that, so that can't be a reasonable expectation.
So that would be a distinction from the use of alcohol, which is
correct.
Also prohibited?
Correct. Alcohol itself is not prohibited, but driving a car while you're drunk is prohibited. And that's one of the main distinctions between this case and the Davis case. Davis, you had a DUI, which was a misdemeanor. Here you have murder, obviously a very severe felony, preceded by methamphetamines, also a felony. Did that answer your question?
I think it sort of begs the question of why are these distinctions important? How does this relate to a test that we're applying to make these distinctions? You sort of go very easily to the fact that if the drug is lawful, even though the use of it in driving is not, then that's sort of one category. But on the other hand, if the use of the drug is unlawful or unlawful to a higher degree, the use itself, then that throws it into a different category. And I guess I'd like to know why. What is the test that we are applying that creates those, that make those distinctions matter?
Trying hard to focus on the question. let me try one answer. This probably won't answer your question. We'll try again. I sense that you're struggling with finding a way to draw a line between this case and the Davis case. I don't think you need to worry about line drawing in this case. Davis and this case stand at opposite ends of the criminal act spectrum. Davis was a DUI, a misdemeanor. In this case, we have felony, second-degree murder, close to the most serious felony there is, which would be first-degree murder. This case is so far off the charts that you can say no one would have a reasonable expectation of coverage in these circumstances. Therefore, the criminal acts exclusion is enforceable. Then there may come future cases where the facts will be closer, move toward the middle, but you don't have to worry about those cases now.
Well, and I appreciate that we may not have to worry about very specific line drawing, but it does seem to me that we have to worry about what sort of principles we announce and apply. And that's what I'm trying to get at here is, what is the test that you use that puts Davis on one end, in this case on the other end, rather than just telling me how different they are?
Well, the basis for Davis was the doctrine of reasonable expectations. Under the doctrine of reasonable expectations, I can read a quote, "An insurer who wishes to avoid liability must not only use clear and unequivocal language indicating its intent, but it must call such living conditions to the attention of the insured. Absent proof of such disclosures, coverage will be deemed to be that which would be expected by the ordinary person." Plaintiffs have already conceded, but not arguing otherwise, that the restrictions on use in the rental agreement are clear and unambiguous, so it's that test. The manner in which the restrictions are presented in the rental agreement also serves to call attention to these terms. And here's where you have some differences between our case and the Davis case. The exclusions are presented on the first page of the rental agreement. They're stated in all capital letters in a separate paragraph. They're introduced in a statement in bold print, and the consequences of violating the restrictions is stated in bold print. In Davis, you had a statement of broad coverage on the front of the agreement in readable print, followed by the exclusions on the back of the agreement in almost unreadable print. Here, the facts are the reverse. On the front of the agreement, you have the exclusions stated in capital letters, preceded by bold, ended by bold, whereas the coverage is stated somewhere else. So the first thing you see is the exclusion: don't use the car to commit a felony. In Davis, you have DUI. Here we have second-degree murder. Under the reasonable expectations test, no customer renting a car expects to use the car to commit murder, or we certainly hope they don't expect to use the car to commit murder. And no customer renting a car and purchasing insurance expects to receive insurance for liability arising from murder.
Now, if the driver that had drank alcohol got into a more serious accident, that certainly could result in vehicular homicide, or depending on the circumstances, even murder charges. What do you do with that? I know I'm asking you about line drawing again, but is it all the consequences of a driving while under the influence of alcohol that one reasonably expects to be insured for, or is there some degree of consequences beyond which reaches beyond reasonable expectations?
Again, I don't think we can say as a matter of law that customers have a reasonable expectation of obtaining coverage for liability arising from use of the rental car to commit a felony. Whether the felony is vehicular homicide or murder, it's still a felony. I don't think it sounds good to say they can have a reasonable expectation of coverage while committing a felony.
Well, so in Davis, if the accident were more serious and a felony were involved, then that would be distinct. I mean, that would, a circumstance like that would distinguish it from Davis, in your view.
Perhaps, but I don't. It's not just the consequences that matter. Here, we don't just have tragic consequences. Here, we have a man who pled guilty to second-degree murder. Second-degree murder is a crime involving the element of knowingly. Knowingly means he was aware that in driving the car, he was substantially certain to kill somebody. The coverage was technically removed at the moment he decided to use the car with an awareness that his conduct was substantially certain to kill somebody. Now, you don't have that analysis until an accident occurs, because you don't do the analysis in the abstract without an accident. But it's not the consequences that determine the coverage. It's his state of mind which makes it felonious before the accident or collision even happens.
I appreciate your attempt to answer it, but you're absolutely right. I'm continuing to struggle with that distinction, with that what point in this scenario of the bad events from the mixture of some drug and driving, at what point the limitations of the reasonable expectations test are met or found.
All this occurs because he eludes the police, right? Under these facts?
that was one factor. That's not the whole story. He was forcing other cars off the road. He was going 100 miles per hour on the wrong side of the road. Cars coming the other direction, if they wished to avoid a head-on collision, had to get out of his way. That's where you have the substantial certainty of killing somebody. Now, eventually, he hits the Bailey's car, and they couldn't get out of the way. But his conduct in driving on the wrong side of the road at 100 miles per hour created the substantial certainty that somebody was going to get killed. Like the judge at his sentencing hearing said, it was like shooting a gun into a room full of people. You don't intend to hit any particular person, but there's a substantial certainty you're going to kill somebody. And so we call it a felony, a second-degree murder. We don't like that kind of conduct. And we certainly don't expect insurance for that kind of conduct.
Well, you know, I'm struggling too. I mean, the difference between negligence and insuring negligence, which, you know, is of course what the rental agent is talking about, and intentional criminal conduct, eluding arrest, the high speed chase. Certainly no reasonable person would assume that they're insured against liability for that, right?
Correct, yes.
I mean, that, and unfortunately, I mean, the way insurance works, we can't just look at the victim. The liability that's being insured is the driver here.
Correct.
And there's got to be exceptions. Everybody understands.
There's exceptions to coverage, exclusions from coverage.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I go back to that idea that you're covered bumper to bumper. How can that create a reasonable expectation of coverage without any exclusions? It can't. It can't be a reasonable expectation. Even if you said you're covered bumper to bumper, that doesn't erase the possibility of exclusions. They have to be there. But again, on the line drawing issue, if I could, I wish I could give you peace of mind about this, but you can apply the Davis factors and see how different we are from the Davis case. You can also say this case is off the spectrum to the right-hand side or left-hand side. DUI, second-degree murder. Somewhere in the middle, you might have to do line drawing. You don't have to do it in this case. You can stake the positions between this case and the Davis case. And still follow the Davis analysis. No reasonable expectation of coverage for murder. And on the issue of intent, we alluded to that here. The question of intent was thoroughly briefed in the trial court. We took his guilty plea to second-degree murder and vehicular homicide, went through the definitions of the crime, and showed what that amounted to as a matter of civil law, a substantial certainty of causing harm. As a matter of law, a presumption of intent to harm or kill is as a matter of law. The trial court didn't have to address the issue of intent, because the trial court resolved the issue on the criminal acts exclusion. The Court of Appeals didn't have to address the issue of intent because they resolved it on the criminal acts exclusion. But if for some reason you feel unease with the current decision and you want to overrule the current decision, please send the case back to the trial court to get a determination on the enforceability of the intent exclusion, where it's been briefed, no decision yet been made, as well as the DUI exclusion and the racing exclusion, but primarily the intent exclusion. Wish my mouth was not to dry out. Excuse me, Your Honors. Turning to the question of public policy is not an abstract, amorphous concept that plaintiffs can use like a magic wand to find coverage under all circumstances. To be a valid tool in legal analysis, public policy must be tied to some concrete, definable principle. The public policy of protecting innocent victims of auto accidents derives from the statements of intent in three statutes: the No-Fault Statute, the Uninsured Motorist Act, and the Motor Vehicle Financial Responsibility Act. But not one of those statutes applies here. The No-Fault Act has been repealed. This case does not involve uninsured motorist coverage, and the public policy behind the Motor Vehicle Financial Responsibility Act was satisfied by the primary coverage provided by Dollar. Plaintiffs also point to Section 10.4.623 of the statute that replaced the No-Fault Act. but that provision concerns the mandatory minimum level of insurance, which was provided by Dollar. So there's no statutory basis for holding that a criminal acts exclusion from excess insurance violates public policy. Absent a statutory basis, the public policy of protecting the innocent victims of accidents has never been employed by itself to strike down an exclusion. Rather, as I see it, it's used as a kind of tiebreaker in cases where something else is going on, such as deception or a technical forfeiture. For example, in the Friedlander case, this court used the public policy of protecting innocent victims of accidents to justify requiring an insurance company to prove prejudice before it could rely on a late notice provision in a policy to deny coverage. This court explained that absent prejudice to the insurance company, reliance on the late notice provision would produce a technical forfeiture. But this case has no element of deception, nor does it involve a technical forfeiture. Nor is there any common law basis for holding that a criminal acts exclusion from excess insurance violates public policy. Plaintiffs cite no case holding that a criminal acts exclusion from excess insurance is contrary to public policy. Instead, plaintiffs cite cases involving criminal acts exclusions and statutorily mandated minimum levels of insurance. The courts in those cases first invalidated the exclusions on public policy grounds because they removed the minimum level of insurance required by statute. Having done that, the court then had to determine what level of insurance remained when the policy provided more insurance than required by statute. Because only the exclusion was invalidated, the remainder of the policy was enforced, including the amount of coverage, even if the policy provided more than statutory minimum. These cases illustrate what is called the severability principle, which states that when an exclusion is invalidated, the remainder of the policy is enforced, including the amount of coverage. But those cases are not controlling here because they all involved a single policy of insurance. Here, it is undisputed, as counsel has admitted, that Raymond Jewell purchased two separate policies of insurance. Because he purchased two separate policies of insurance, nullification of the criminal acts exclusion in the primary insurance provided by Dollar has no effect on the supplemental or excess insurance provided by Lincoln General. To get around that difficulty, plaintiffs argue that from the customer's point of view, there is in effect only one policy of insurance. But there are two problems with that argument. First, plaintiffs did not make that argument in the trial court. The debate in the trial court focused on the enforceability of the exclusions. Second, if you accept plaintiff's argument that the two policies are effectively merged into one, then Lincoln General can rely on the step-down clause in paragraph H1 of the rental agreement. The enforceability of step-down clauses is an open question in Colorado, but by far the vast majority of states to consider the issue hold them to be enforceable. So if this court accepts plaintiff's argument and views the two policies as merged into one, then this court should also align Colorado with the majority of jurisdictions that uphold step-down clauses and enforce the step-down clause in paragraph H1 of the rental agreement. Again, I'd say that if you feel uncomfortable with the current decision and feel compelled to overturn the Court of Appeals, please remand the case all the way to the trial court to consider the remaining three exclusions, intentional act, DUI, and racing. Any further questions? Thank you for your time.
I'd like to answer the question that Justice Rice asked to begin. Did the clerk tell him about supplemental insurance? This is set forth in the briefs, but the answer to that is no. The clerk didn't even know what supplemental insurance was. And Mr. Jewell didn't know he had two policies because the clerk didn't know to tell him. Nobody knew that. Now, there was a lot of discussion about this language is on the front page. You have this, but I've highlighted where the language is. This was a pamphlet that folded up, folds out, and when you go to read it, you know, the notice, and I guess it's a question of reasonable expectations, is there notice of that a criminal act or driving while intoxicated could void coverage is buried in here, and that's something that you'll have to look at in your de novo review. But again, I would respectfully disagree that with the proposition, well, everybody knows this is a criminal act. What happened here is this kid, and he was a kid, he was, I think, 19 years old, went out and got intoxicated and drove the car and made some really bad decisions.
Oh, well, he eluded the police, right?
Yeah, it was a high-speed chase.
Okay, the lights are on, yes, he takes off.
That's true.
Everybody in the society knows you can't do that, right?
After he's already drunk, Your Honor, after he's already high, I mean, kids make bad decisions.
Don't, we don't use drunkenness to excuse an act.
I'm not saying that, that's not really my point, that that should be an excuse. Any intent here, if there was any at all, was not to go out and kill somebody. That was an unfortunate consequence. This is like Davis. Somebody got intoxicated. They drove the car. But the point here is, and it goes back to the question Justice Rice asked me, I think that you're struggling with, is there a reasonable expectation of coverage? Well, under the Myers case, yes, there is. And this is so garbled up with insurance coverage and rental terms in the same contract, and you have to flip back and forth, that you can't tell. The clerk didn't know what the difference in the coverages was. Clerk didn't know there were two policies. Certainly Jewel didn't know. And I do want to talk about the Davis case and the extent. I agree with the language that was read to you, that it basically says there has to be notice, and these exclusions have to be called to the attention of the insured. And in this case, I guess that's one of the things you'll have to determine. And the issue of step-down insurance came up, and I'm familiar with, I think it was argued the end of September, the Shelter case, where this court is determining step-downs. And it is an open question in this case, but what's not an open question is, if step-downs are going to be enforceable, there has to be adequate notice of a step-down in coverage. And I would submit to you that from the reasonable expectations test, this is just one big lump of coverage, and this is a step-down provision, and the provisions weren't called to the attention of the insured, and therefore cannot be enforced.
This is an off-the-point question, but I'm just trying to get a sense of what happened. He said this man, Jewel, was only 19 years old.
19 or 20.
How was he even able to rent a car? I thought you had to be 26.
Well, that was a violation of the dollar policy. It would happen at 2 o'clock in the morning with an untrained clerk, and you know, dollar only had $25,000 or $50,000 in coverage, and you know, that question as to whether that was a negligent conduct of dollars part was certainly,
it's not really
mine. Yeah, but
pertinent, I suppose. I'm just trying to get a sense of what
should have happened. It goes to dollars liability and dollar through in the policy limits. Miss Bailey was in the hospital for months, several hundreds of thousands of dollars of medical bills that have not been and cannot be addressed in any other way than proceeding here. There's talk about public policy, and there are competing public policies here, clearly. And I think the determination that has to be made is, in this circumstance, which public policy outweighs the others. And we think when the person that purchased the insurance is not benefiting, there's a strong public policy to protect victims in this state. It's set out in the insurance statutes, and it's one thing to say, well, you know, it wasn't set out specifically in this context, but it was set out throughout the insurance statutes in three different places, as indicated, and that's the public policy that ought to prevail under these circumstances. But more importantly, this doesn't have to come down to public policy. Even if if public policy is tiebreaker, great, because I think Julie Bailey and the loss of her son and the hideous injuries that she underwent an example of why we need to compensate people in that circumstance that are innocent victims. But you don't have to get to that point, because the fact of the matter is these exclusions were not adequately called to anybody's attention. The clerk said you've got coverage. It's reasonable to believe there's at least some coverage for getting drunk and crashing your car. And because these were so garbled up, you know, it's not reasonable to think that somebody would say, oh, I have coverage up to here and not to here. It could have been done right. It wasn't done right. And we're asking the court not to rewrite the policy, but to enforce the long-established law of the Davis case. And I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Could I ask you one question about Davis? It's such a mainstay of what you're arguing. Remember in Davis,
what was it, like a 4-2 decision, and you had a separate opinion by Justice Lohr, who really, joined by Rivera, who kind of says, you know, we really don't have to deal with all of this balancing test stuff, because in this case, these people practically tried to hide these things from the driver. And I think at one point he says something like the exclusion was virtually impossible to read or something like that. Makes a big point how bad it was. Whether we were to take that to read the full balancing test of the majority as being somewhat dictish or not, should we at least consider how extreme that case seemed to be in terms of hiding the provisions in deciding how to work our balance, in deciding that was a major factor in the Davis court's balance?
You know, I've gone back and looked at that very carefully and would suggest to you that this is really no different. They talk about bold print, but bold print is mixed in and small type, and there's so much bold print it becomes indecipherable, and it's pretty, I think it's a fair reading of what we have here, that these exclusions were also buried in the middle, and that it says if you violate these, then you could lose benefits and protections and optional coverages. Well, there's no disclosure that what an optional coverage is. You know, there's no definition of benefits or protections, and so there's just no notice. And I believe, Your Honor, respectfully, that this is every bit as egregious as the Davis case. However, it really boils down to, is there adequate notice? If this is a step-down provision, is there adequate notice? And there just isn't. And it was because they had an untrained clerk at 2 o'clock in the morning that said, yeah, you've got full coverage. They had a summary of insurance there that they didn't provide to him. Nobody made any effort to call it to his attention. In fact, the record will demonstrate that they had a policy. We want to get you in and out of here in 10 minutes. And he got out of there in between 5 and 6 minutes. But he drove this car for a long period of time, a few weeks before this happened. And he did go out and get tanked up. And it's a horrible situation for the family that has to live with that. And he did step up and take responsibility and plead guilty to the vehicular homicide charge. But the fact of the matter is he thought reasonably, objectively, a reasonable person would think that they had coverage, at least for driving up to a point. And there's just no attempt here to distinguish. There's no notice that you can lose it in some circumstances, can't lose it in others. I'm not saying it can't be done right. I'm saying it wasn't done right in this case. And I, you know, Justice Rice, I feel badly, and Justice Martinez, I don't think I ever really answered your questions, but you're right, they're very difficult questions. And, you know, the best answer I can give you is this could have been done right, but it wasn't. It's all jumbled up in the agreements. The insurance language is jumbled up with the rental car language. He was told, oh, don't worry about it. You've got full coverage bumper to bumper. And in light of existing Colorado law, it could have certainly been reasonable for him to think under these circumstances, if somebody got hurt as a result of his actions, that there was third-party coverage. And in fact, why else would he buy this if he didn't want to protect someone in the place situation, Julie Bailey? And I think that this court should recognize that the strong public policy is to protect people in her position and find coverage here when the insurance company could have done it right, but they just didn't.
Let me just say, I appreciate your answers. I don't feel that you didn't answer my questions or difficult questions, and you helped us think about it, as Justice Rice indicated, and we appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand under submission. We'll be in recess until 1:30 this afternoon.